This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 73, and I'm your host, Simon Bowne. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. And every Thursday, I release an episode called Paranormal Stories, and that has UFO cases as well as information on evidence of an afterlife. And you can find that as part of the Past Lives podcast. And if you want to hear the extended version of this episode, you'll need to sign up to Patreon, where there are now over 70 episodes in the back catalogue. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. This week I'm talking to Graham Rendell about his book, Intercept and Identify, Aerial UFO Encounters 1953-1954. Graham is a full-time author and commentator on the unidentified aerial phenomena issue. He is also a contributor to The Debrief, an American news website dealing with cutting-edge science, tech, and defense news, and a frequent guest on various podcasts looking at UAP. He also writes on the subject for UAP Media UK. Between 1990 and 1992, he was the editor of an amateur aviation magazine. Graham has written a critically acclaimed work looking at the Foo Fighters witnessed during World War II. Hi, Graham. Thanks a lot for coming back to the podcast.
Hello, Simon. Thanks again for re-inviting me, if you like. It's wonderful to be here. Thanks.
So we're going to talk about your book. It's called Intercept and Identify Aerial UFO Encounters 1953 to 1954, which is like a really short period of time. So there must have been a lot going on in that period to fill a whole book.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, this comes hot on the heels of the two weekends in July 1952, if you like, where the US Air Force were at a loss to do anything about these things that were seen over Washington, D.C., the nation's capital. And then the US Air Force came out with a press conference immediately afterwards, the following week, on the Monday rather, to try and play down everything. And the press basically bought into the explanations that they were giving about, there's nothing to see here, move on, these are temperature inversions, they're radar angels, if you like, and all the rest of it. And the idea was, or the expectation was, that things would die down. And of course, the press sort of backed away from the kind of fevered interest there were in all these UFO sightings in America. But actually, things were kicking off elsewhere in the world. Things started to be seen down in South America, and they were starting to be seen in Europe quite a lot as well, and reported. And even in America, the scale didn't really diminish. So yes, you're right. There's plenty to write about, even for a short period of time, like 1953 to 1954. Now, it's the book's not just about the UFO sightings. Obviously, as the title suggests, there's a little bit about about the encounters. Sorry, there's quite a lot about the encounters, but actually woven into the story, like I've done in the other two books in the series, there's a bits about the kind of investigations that were going on in the background, and how those were sort of progressing, if you like.
Can you go over what happened in Washington? Because that kind of is linked to all this, isn't it?
Well, because it happens obviously just like 6 months or 5 months before this book starts. So yeah, you're looking at the last two full weekends in July 1952. And the first weekend, the radar controllers at Washington National Airport see they're not quite fleets, but there's quite a lot of unidentified sort of contacts on the radar. And people are actually seeing things in the skies as well. So they're seeing them from the Andrews Air Force Base as well. And pilots who are flying in on scheduled flights into Washington are reporting seeing strange lights in the sky around the Capitol as well. And one aircraft, the pilot is asked to go and investigate one particular contact because quite close to him. But by the time they scramble interceptors, then these lights disappear and the contacts disappear when the F-94 Starfires get on the scene. And then as soon as they move away because they've ran low on the fuel and the pilots have to return to base, these things are back again. And the thought, well, okay, this might just be a one-off, and they may have chalked it down to problems with the radar systems or people seeing things, all the rest of it, but it actually happened the following weekend as well. So, the weekends, I think it was the 19th and 20th, and then the 26th and 27th of July, 1952. Effectively, it was almost like a siege, if you like, of Washington, D.C., the capital of the USA. And, the US Air Force which at that time was probably the most advanced air force in the world in terms of the technology and the aircraft they had, they couldn't do anything about these things. So as soon as they appeared on the scene, these things just vanished. And then as soon as they had to go back for fuel, they reappeared. So it was almost as if these things were controlling events. And you know, the US Air Force were at a loss to explain what was happening, but they're also at a loss to control events as well, to control their own airspace. So yeah, it was quite a strange time, but it was almost like the summit of things that were happening. There'd been an increase in numbers of sightings ever since, you know, Kenneth Arnold's sort of event in June 1947, and it had just increased and increased and increased. So the papers were picking up on all the cases that were happening, and you know, pages and pages and columns and inches of coverage about stories about flying saucers, UFOs, all the rest of it. But it built up to these 2 weekends. And then the US Air Force held this press conference. They had high-ranking senior officers from Air Intelligence giving, you know, sort of statements to the press. And of course, the press bought it, because why wouldn't they? You know, there was quite a lot of trust in the Air Force back then. It had just come off the backs of World War II, and they were still in the Korean conflict. So naturally, there was quite a lot of respect and also a lot of trust for people standing on a podium and saying, yeah, you know, this is what's going on. Don't worry about it. So they expected everything just to go away, to blow over. But the UFOs, clearly whoever's operating them or whatever this phenomena is, had different ideas. And these things were still being seen right through into, you know, the mid-50s, where this book sort of looks at the 53 and 54. And as I say, the numbers of sightings just didn't really diminish at all. If anything, it just kept going, and also much more from around the world as well.
And you also put in the timeline of official United States Air Force UFO investigation projects, which was it Sign and then Grudge and then Blue Book?
That's correct. So yeah, I do this for each of the books I've written on the aerial encounters from the late 40s through to this book. So it just gives people an idea of those three official yet fairly secret at the time official United States Air Force intelligence in UFO investigations, because they were slightly different. They came along at different times. Sign was the first one. And that was when, you know, they simply had seemingly no idea what was going on, and they were desperately trying to find answers. And then when the people behind Sign came with what they call an estimate of the situation, which is effectively a kind of a briefing, if you like, for senior intelligence people saying, well, look, this is what we think is going on. It was battered back down by senior officers because there wasn't any proof behind it. There was a kind of theory as, you know, we don't think they're from here, if you like. But obviously the US Air Force hierarchy couldn't accept that, because it had nothing to really back it up, because there was simply no evidence. It was just a suggestion, because they couldn't reconcile it with the technology of the time. So it shifted the kind of emphasis about trying to explain things from then shifted to much more mundane things. So when Grudge came along, which started in 1949, then the emphasis was on trying to prove that it was effectively domestic technology, albeit possibly Russian. And that's where the focus went. So you can see all this kind of, you know, jumping through hoops to try and prove it was some kind of like maybe foreign interference. Or if it wasn't that, then it was Venus, or it was, you know, mirages or reflections from cockpit instruments and all the rest of it. And this is where this kind of sort of trying to explain things away in very, very simple terms and mundane terms, that's where it all sprang from. And then Grudge itself, it got really run down in terms of how serious I think that they were behind it, because they weren't getting anywhere either with it. And it got run down to the point where it was almost like a project in name only. And then when Edward Ruppelt came along, he was an Air Force captain, and he took over Grudge in about, late in 51. And then it morphed into what was then Blue Book, which a lot of people obviously who study the UFO issue will know that name. And that was a much more long-running UFO investigation that kicked off in March 1952 and ran right through to 1969. But the seeds were there again to explain things in much more mundane terms, even if some of the explanations simply didn't make sense based on the testimony of the pilots or the witnesses. and what other evidence, such as it was, existed.
So it was a kind of thing where it went from doing real investigations and over the years becoming more and more of just a debunking project.
I think there were certainly investigations all the way through, but the level and the scale of those investigations, I think, was quite patchy. They didn't have the resources. I don't think they've ever had the resources to look through things really, really thoroughly. A lot of the time, even with Sign and Grudge as well, it was a case of they would ring up the local Air Force station and they would ask them, you know, have you released, or airport, and say, have you released any weather balloons? And that was a standard tactic, because obviously they wanted to try and rule that out. And sometimes even it was ruled out, then that would be the explanation, because yes, they've released a balloon that day, you know, and that was trying to just bring something fairly mundane into the explanation. But they would talk to other Air Force bases around the area to see whether any of their aircraft had been in the vicinity at the time. So there was various things that they did. Occasionally, they would send people out to the places concerned to interrogate the pilots. But most of the time, it was actually local intelligence officers from the squadrons or the units concerned. If you were talking about military aircrew, they were the people who would interview the witnesses straight away, get the details, and then that would be passed on to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, which was where Sign, Grudge, and then later Blue Book, that's where they all operated from. So you can see this kind of, you know, it was like different stages in the process. And a lot of the time that Sign, Grudge, or Blue Book, what they would do would follow up the initial kind of receipt of information just to maybe clarify some details or ask some further questions. Or sometimes they would say, well, look, that doesn't sound right. You know, can you clarify this kind of thing? So there'll be a lot of that. So there was very few boots on the ground, if you like, in terms of the people who were behind the project. But they were quite happy to accept information from people who are much closer to the source of the sightings, the local intelligence officers. And then as this book I've just written explains, then in about 1953, the Blue Book, they were talking to a unit called the 4602nd AISS, which is an intelligence unit. It was an Air Force intelligence unit. And they were trying to get them, which this unit had branches, departments, if you like, or detachments, all across the United States, quite a few of them. And they were trying to get their personnel to do the investigations on the ground, because they were spread out all over the country. And it was quite easy to get them on board, because one of their tasks really was to look at possible captured Soviet equipment, if they ever came into contact with it. Not that they did, but all the time. But if they ever did, let's say, for argument's sake, something might have crashed on US soil at some stage. Again, not that it did, but that would be they would be the people who would look at it and would examine it and you know, all this kind of state, look at the technology. They did things like that in Korea with captured North Korean stuff. But the idea would be that was their proper role, whereas they could also use UFO investigations as a bit of a training kind of exercise, because they would be interrogating witnesses. But they'd also be trying to look at any kind of evidence that was amassed. So photography, so yes, it was photographs of strange objects, to see whether it was some kind of new technology that the Americans weren't aware of, or let's say for anything that might have crashed, if it was, oh yeah, this is a bit of a UFO, then they would be the perfect people possibly to examine this kind of stuff as well. So there's all this kind of stuff going on in the background. So this unit actually did end up doing some of the initial investigation work for Blue Book. But again, it was like the intelligence officers in the field, that information just got passed on to this to Blue Book at Wright-Patterson.
And if you think about how many sightings there were around this time, particularly military, and they were reporting on craft that could easily outmaneuver their interceptor jets, and they seem to be able to move through US airspace anytime they wanted to, and there's nothing they could do about it.
Exactly. I mean, the top line interceptor, let's say, you know, late 1952, 1953, would be the F-94 Starfire. It was getting a little bit long in the tooth then, and there were other aircraft coming on stream by then. But that they still sort of, I guess, provided the mainstay of the all-weather interceptors, so the night fighters, if you like, or the ones that had to fly in bad weather. And they were the aircraft that a lot of the time were first on the scene when there was something reported. And if the scrambled jets to go after after these objects that were reported, but sometimes there were F-86 Sabres, which is quite a fast aircraft. But even these high performance jets were just being outpaced by these objects, sometimes two or three times the speed. And if you're looking at something that can do 600 or 700 miles an hour, that quite a fast jet for those those times, then whatever these objects were breaking records in terms of airspeed. So they were going a lot quicker. But it wasn't anything that the Russians could build or the Chinese definitely could build then, and certainly not what the Americans seemed to be capable of either. So it's a complete loss to explain what these things actually were.
And it seems that the response to these reports from reliable witnesses was to, even at one point, reduce Blue Book to just a single member of staff. Surely they should have been more interested.
Well, that actually goes, the thing is, because that flies in the face of something called the Robinson Panel, which they convened in January 1953. The CIA had basically wanted effectively like an audit, if you like, of Blue Book and the UFO investigations. And they sort of wanted that in 1952 to see whether there was anything behind what, you know, people were saying these things might be, or whether there were foreign technology. So they managed to get this panel of scientists together, and it was it was headed by somebody who had been a radar specialist in World War II, and he'd actually been in London and he'd liaised with people who were trying to combat the V2s and the V1 flying bombs, etc. So he was quite a well-known person, he was the chairman of, he gave his name to the Robinson panel. But one of their recommendations was that they should increase the size of Blue Book. They should throw more resources at it. They should staff it even more than it was, to do a kind of outreach program to inform the public effectively, to say, look, you know, these things you're seeing in the skies, or you're saying they're seeing in the skies, you're mistaking everyday objects, you know, other aircraft or stars or Venus, all the rest of it, for strange things. And it's only because you don't have enough information or enough knowledge about what you're looking at that's why you're misidentifying these things. And if we can educate you into, you know, sort of seeing something and say, oh yeah, well, that's really what that is, then this will all just go away. So you would have thought that the Air Force might have taken that on board, because they basically swallowed all the other recommendations that the Robinson panel had set up. But no, they didn't. As you say, the actual personnel at one stage went down with single airmen, and that was only because Ruppelt had been, he went somewhere else on a temporary duty for a few months and then came back to the project. And in his absence, there was a single lieutenant and an airman who basically took over the reins of the program. And then the lieutenant himself effectively retired. He left the service, I think. And that went down, so it went down to a single airman, a guy called Max Fuchs. And he was effectively in sole charge of running Blue Book, which is absolutely crazy.
And do you think the guys that were on the Robertson panel really did believe that if they had enough information, every case could be solved?
Well, they didn't look at that many cases. So in detail, I think they looked at something like maybe 10 or 12 cases. It wasn't that many. And I think they had some other information on a few more. But there was quite a lot of cases that were missed out. So it was almost like they cherry-picked certain ones, possibly that they could maybe explain away in much more rational terms. It's unclear as to what the criteria were for selecting these particular cases. But one way or another, they just, you know, said there was nothing to the UFO issue, and it was simply people just misidentifying things, you know, such as that could be explained in rational terms. So it was really weird.
And do you think that there were other projects going on? Because we talked about Sign and Grudge and Blue Book, and maybe they were a front, and actually there was I'm getting all conspiracy theory here, aren't I? And actually there was another group doing investigations that we've never really heard of.
I guess it's possible. I mean, obviously, you know, there's all this kind of MJ12 nonsense that goes around. But as far as I'm concerned, that's probably a hoax, just by the manner that it was disseminated to various people before it became public knowledge. However, you know, if there is a grain of truth in that particular thing, then it's been very well hidden over the years. So if there is some kind of parallel investigation program, then, you know, it's something that hasn't really come out of the woodwork. There's no smoking gun in terms of documentation beyond those possibly, you know, sort of hoaxed MJ12 documents to suggest that something else was going on in the background when Sign, Grudge and Blue Book were in the foreground. But you've got to remember that those were secret as well. The first evidence of Sign and Grudge came along, you know, a couple of years later when there was a press release to say that the US Air Force had something called Project Saucer. You know, that's what they called it officially in terms of the public side. So even the, you know, the names were still kind of, you know, secret. And actually they blurred the two projects into one and called it Project Saucer. So as far as the public were concerned, there was just this one particular program when actually there'd been two and they'd followed on from each other. So, you know, even the actual ones that we know about were still secret. So if there was another one in the background that was even more secret, if you like, then they've done a really, really good job of concealing that information up to now.
So can we talk about one of the cases in the book, Cyril Townsend Withers?
Oh, the chap in the Canberra.
Yeah.
So this is a weird one because he gave this information to Jenny Randles, who's a UFO researcher from, you know, who people will recognize that name, and she was certainly around in the 80s and 90s. You know, you would see her in books and magazines back then, and she, I think it was in one of her books, she came out and she sort of, you know, reproduced this testimony from this chap who'd been he'd been part of a test crew flying experimental aeroplanes back in the early 1950s. And he was in a Canberra, which is a twin jet bomber. It was the first RAF jet bomber. And it was quite a fast aircraft. It could fly quite high. And one day, a pilot and him, they were both out testing some particular kit for this aeroplane. And according to his particular evidence, they saw this object. But the only thing is, what he says was that he climbed into the rear turret of the aeroplane to get a closer look at it. And it was described as round, like a thin disc, but with two small tail fins at the rear. And it was metallic and enormous. And apparently it was just sitting there waiting for them to fly right into it. And then it supposedly flipped vertically into the air and climbed upwards at an astonishing rate. So that's all very well. But the thing that got me kind of a bit concerned about the testimony is what I just said before about the Cyril Townsend Withers. He said he climbed into the rear gun turret of the Canberra. Well, anybody who knows what a Canberra looks like will know there's no turret. It didn't have any defensive armament. It wasn't like a World War II bomber with gun turrets fitted in it. The Canberra relied on its speed alone to evade enemy fighters. You know, the suggestion that this aircraft had a gun turret in it, let alone one you could climb into to look at a UFO, sort of, you know, sets alarm bells going at me with me. And I'm just thinking, well, if that's, you know, completely off the wall, then what else with the story doesn't add up?
Because wasn't the radar station, didn't they pick up the UFO?
Well, yeah, there's something else as well that, you know, it might have had some kind of secondary contact in terms of that. But it's just the fact that if one bit of a story like that's a little bit sort of hazy, then you just have to wonder what else is kind of suspect with that story.
If we talk about another one, there's the Kinross incident. And I believe with that one, that aircraft was never found.
That's right. So you look at November 1953, and there's a crew who were the crew of an all-weather interceptor, which was based up near Lake Michigan in the States. And the pilot was called Gene Moncler, and basically they're scrambled, him and his radar operator, and they're scrambled on an intercept mission from a place called Kinross, which is in Upper Michigan. And there's a, well, there's an unidentified contact over Lake Superior. So the aircraft scrambled and it's vectored towards this target. And as the radar operator is looking at the aircraft and this mysterious contact, the two merge. But then the aircraft doesn't fly away from the contact, and the object just, you know, flies away and disappears. And the aircraft's never seen again. So there's no wreckage, there's no trace of the crew. But the explanation is given that it was an off-course Royal Canadian Air Force aircraft, transport aircraft, that was the mystery contact. And that's what the US Air Force decided that was the cause of the scramble. But if that's the case, then what happened to the aeroplane? Why did it, you know, why was it lost? And why is no trace of the aircraft ever been found? So it's a complete mystery. And in any case, the pilot of a Canadian Air Force air transport that was actually in the area at the time, which, you know, would seem to be the one that the Americans were saying, oh yeah, that's the cause of the scramble. He actually came forward and said that he's never been off course in his life, and he would never have flown that far away from his assigned route. So, you know, there's kind of little bits to the story which don't make sense either. And there was certainly a huge search for the aircraft. It lasted a couple of days. But, you know, to this day, there's never been any conclusive kind of evidence that anything, you know, little bits of wreckage or a life raft or, you know, the bodies themselves, or the pilot or the radar operator, were ever washed up on the shores of the lake. So it is a complete mystery.
And also, if it was the other blip on the radar, mm-hmm. was the American aircraft, why didn't that get damaged if they came together enough to destroy the first one?
Well, if it was a mid-air collision, you'd expect both aircraft to be lost, or at least the second aircraft, say the Canadian transport, to have, you know, visible damage. And the Canadians never ever owned up to anything like that. They said, you know, they didn't have an aircraft in the particular area where this contact was, and that was the end of it effectively. So, you know, the Canadians denied all knowledge of being involved, but the Americans sort of insisted at the time that it had been an off-course Canadian Air Force transport. So it's like, who do you believe? But even so, why would an American jet interceptor be lost if it was investigating, you know, an aircraft that had gone off course? None of it really made sense. The only thing was that the F-89 Scorpion, which is the type of aircraft that was involved, it had a poor safety record. And actually, at the same time this one was lost, another aircraft was actually lost as well, much closer to centers of population. So I guess in the background, there's always the possibility that it was simply mechanical failure, or a failure of the airframe itself, that actually, you know, led to the loss of the aeroplane. And for some reason, you know, how many years now, we're 70 years ahead this year, that nothing, you know, for some reason, none of the wreckage ever has ever come to light.
And wasn't there a hoax? Somebody claimed they'd found it?
That's right. In the early 2000s, there was a company, there was a spokesman for a company called, they were calling themselves the Great Lakes Diving Company. And this, the chap, though, the spokesman, had suggested or alleged that they had some sophisticated radar gear, or sonar gear, rather, and they'd actually got a kind of a ping off a kind of image, if you like, a radar image, off an aircraft lying on on the lake bed. And, you know, the idea was that they were going to, you know, going to get a party together to retrieve the aeroplane or at least go down and get pictures of it, et cetera, et cetera. And then it was supposed to be, you know, reasonably intact. So that was like kind of an explanation. And everybody at the time went, oh, well, that might solve this. And, you know, if we can get some idea of what the state of the aircraft was in and all the rest of it. But it turns out it was a cruel hoax, because when the company was investigated, no such company existed. And then the actual spokesman disappeared off the face of the earth. So if it was a hoax, it was a very cruel one for the families and descendants of the crew who were lost back in November 1953.
And I wanted to talk about a couple of other cases. There was something similar about them. There's the DC-3 airliner that was heading for Rio de Janeiro.
So what I think it is, and I can't remember the actual date or the year, it's one of 53 or 54, there was the one where they were being chased by something like that. And it was quite hazardous to the aeroplane. But there was other pilots of Brazilian aircraft in the area had seen it as well, and the last thing they saw of it was heading out to sea. but the object themselves, it was just the start of quite a few cases that were actually, you know, sort of reported from the likes of Brazil and Venezuela. So you even at that time, 53, 54, there were quite a few sort of cases coming out of South America.
And with this one, they said there was a huge fireball that kept closing in on it repeatedly, yeah, on a collision course.
Yeah, that's what I say. This is the one I think it is. It turns out it was also, you know, something that clearly was responding to them in terms of being very, very close to the aircraft. And you'd expect something if it was another airplane, let's say, or, you know, something like that, and they would be keeping well clear. You wouldn't want to endanger another airplane. So it's very strange as to what the maneuvers this object, whatever it was making, and why it was trying to endanger another airplane.
Because some skeptics might say if it's a huge fireball, then it's probably a meteorite.
Yeah, but meteorites don't maneuver. That's the thing.
Yeah, yeah. And then there's James Salandin.
Yes, he's a meteor pilot on the cover of the airplane. I'm just going to go back to that one because I actually have found it where it was. I wanted,
okay,
to make sure. Yeah. It was a Varig airliner, which was the large Brazilian airline back in those days. It's a guy called Nagib Ayub. He's the pilot. And he said it was a bright red light and it was glowing about 500 meters above the plane and it vanished. And then they flew a little bit further. And then they saw it again. And as he described before, it was a huge fireball closing in on them. So it wasn't just seen once. It was seen again by the same crew. They described it as being a round blob of hot metal sweeping through the night sky. And they thought it was apparently bigger than a full moon. And it looked to be approaching on a collision course. And of course, they thought, oh, it's going to hit us. And then it turned away, even reversing course as it got much closer to them. But then, rather than just fly off, it made another turn and actually tried to close on them again. So they had to then, it moved away just before it hit them. So this kind of, I guess, a dangerous game, it was repeated a few times, apparently over a period of 10 minutes. So you can imagine the kind of response of the crew. They must have been, afraid for their wits kind of thing. This thing, they just didn't have any kind of defense against it. But then it flew off. And apparently there was another crew who'd seen it as well, a similar crew from the same airline, that they'd seen it heading out to sea at about the same time. So there was, kind of cooperation of a sort about the particular, about the object that they'd seen. But yeah, going back to James Salandin, the meteor pilot that you mentioned there. So this is over the south of England in October 1954. And it constitutes the cover of the book as well. So you can see this strange object that the jet fighter pilot has come across, and he reckoned that he thought it was an airplane. He thought it was an airplane first of all, but it was a really weird looking thing because he thought it had it was like a flange in the middle and two bulges above and below. It was almost like a pie plate with a similar thing underneath. But he thought there was two objects. One was silver and one was gold, and they passed near the aircraft. So you can see it on the book cover. They've got the silver one, which is near the aircraft, and there's like another one as well depicted on the rear cover. But this is about 16,000 feet over Northumberland in England, so down near the Thames Estuary area.
And the similar thing there is that with the meteor, mm-hmm, the UFO nearly collided with him.
Well, yes, yeah. Yeah, it was quite close to his aircraft. It was also quite close to some other aircraft that were flying nearby as well. So it's another one of these ones where whatever these things are, however they're controlled, then they don't seem too bothered about being in close proximity to other airplanes.
One thing that you point out in the book, which I've always wondered about, is that the UFOs were not seem like there's just one or two designs. It seems like there are all sorts of designs there, like a factory would have to be changing what they're doing every day almost.
Well, that's it. I mean, you name it, you can almost like describe different shapes and sizes and speeds and maneuverability. They're all different in different ways. And if it had been, let's say, for argument's sake, a Russian design, then you'd think they would settle on one or maybe, a handful of different kind of prototypes. And then, if they were going to send them, sort of nefariously over America, then they might be seen. But it would only be restricted to a handful of types and handful of shapes. But as you say, the UFOs, you know, they were all shapes and all sizes. And sometimes these things, as another case in the book, they actually change shape as well. So that's a really strange one as well. And as far as I'm aware, we don't have, you know, aircraft which can change shape. Yes, okay, they can change the wing geometry on airplanes, but that's not the same as being described by the witness in the particular case I've just mentioned there.
And also, I think there's a couple where they say that it looks like it's one object and then it splits into two or three.
Yeah, there's certainly a case, the Labrador case from 1954, where there's a British aircrew of a passenger airplane, and they see one, well, what they think is one large object, but actually turns out there's six or seven nearby, and then the middle one is much larger, and it starts changing shape. So that's the one I'm mentioning there. And that was quite weird, because the official explanation, or in terms of what, you know, what the American Air Intelligence suggested it might be, and they thought, well, it could be Mars, you're seeing. And as far as I'm concerned, Mars isn't accompanied by six or seven other shapes, and certainly doesn't change its shape anyway.
Some of the explanations that are given for these things are just bizarre and so obviously nonsense. Like saying it's Mars, but there was something on radar. So you're not going to get Mars on radar.
Well, the thing is, you were starting to get radar visual cases by about this time. So you'd get, you know, there was corroboration of a sort. So you'd have the pilots who would see things, but then the radar would pick up something in the same vicinity. And a good tactic from the likes of Blue Book would be to separate the two parts of the case. So they would explain the radar side as being just a malfunction, or a temperature inversion, or ground clutter or something like that, which would, you know, they would then explain that part of the case away. And then they would say that the pilot had just seen Venus or something else like that. So, you know, they would separate the two parts of the case to actually explain them in isolation. And it just so happened that they'd seem to have happened at the same time. But really, you know, their explanations themselves didn't really stack up. But that was the tactic that seemed to be used more and more.
And was there a culture of derision towards pilots who reported something? And so it became more and more that pilots would just want to keep their mouth shut.
Yes, certainly. There was, and already, even before 1953, there were signs that scheduled airline pilots, like for American Airlines, etc., they were keeping their mouths shut because they'd already seen what would happen to people who had, you know, put the head above the parapet and come forward with sightings. And Ed Ruppelt himself, the head of Blue Book at the time, in 1952, he was on a stopover, I think it was in Chicago, and he just got chatting to the flight crew. And when they realized that he was head of the UFO investigation program, they actually had an impromptu meeting in a nearby coffee shop next to the airport with about six or seven pilots, airline pilots. And then during the course of the conversation, Ruppelt recalled that, you know, a few of them had said, look, you know, if we see some, we're not going to say anything about it because of what's happened to other people who have come forward. And that's where the stigma sort of started. And you can imagine that, you know, things that were seen, reported, and then just, you know, sort of explained away as Venus or what have you, then if that gets back to management in an airline, then they're going to start wondering, you know, about what the kind of mental state of a pilot would be, and are they fit to fly? And there's a kind of reputational damage being done here. But of course, it's the same in the military as well, because you have all these highly trained, highly professional, and very observant aircrew who are reporting things. But then the upshot from the investigation is, again, you've seen Venus, or you've seen a cockpit reflection. Well, these pilots, you know, they knew that's what they weren't seeing, because a lot of the time they were actually at pains to explain that was the case. And yet those were the explanations that were put forward and put into the official record. So naturally, there's reputational damage there as well. You probably get some kind of derision from their squadron colleagues or from their immediate commanders. You know, you can imagine it might even do some damage to their prospects for promotion as well. So yeah, naturally there's going to be a culture built up that, you know, oh, we're not going to report this kind of thing because it could influence me being promoted, you know, the next rank up or taking command of a squadron at some stage in the future, or, you know, flying some type of aircraft or all the rest of it, that, you know, they're just not going to get involved. It's better just to keep quiet. Yes, okay, we'll discuss it with some of our friends and mates on the squadron or some of our colleagues in the airline, but that's as far as it's going to go. So you can see it building from this point. And it just got worse in terms of the stigma, and then became company policy in some respects, in some places, that you couldn't discuss this kind of thing. And then, of course, the Air Force as well cracked down quite quickly on air crew actually coming forward and talking to the press. So one way or another, whether it was stigma or whether it was regulations, you know, people just weren't talking. And the RAF did exactly the same as well. Some of the first cases, the RAF crews used to come on the media. They would talk to your radio reporters or the BBC, etc. And you can look online and you can see some of these early interviews. But then the RAF actually put standing instructions down that they couldn't speak to the media before permission was given. And usually the case, it wasn't given, or if it was given, it was because things had been explained away in ordinary terms.
It seems quite patronising, really, for somebody in an office to say they know better than the pilot what was there when they've sat in an office. They might have not have even been a pilot their whole lives.
You'd think so, wouldn't you? And a lot of the times these intelligence officers were, you know, they were desk officers, and they were just going on what the air crew had said, and then they would chase it up with the local airfield or the local airport to see, you know, about the weather balloons and other aircraft in the area. And if there was a hint, even just a hint of something being in the same area, not necessarily at the same time, but maybe an hour beforehand or an hour afterwards, or if a weather balloon had been released from an airport, say, you know, 50 miles away, and there was just the merest, like, hope that something had drifted into the airspace, even though the winds suggested that that couldn't be the case, then that would be the explanation for it. And it would just, you know, fly in the face of everything else that was actually happening, even to the point of where there was a case from 1948 of an aircraft who had, like, effectively a dogfight over Fargo with a light. And that was explained away as a weather balloon, except, you know, the weather balloons back then from that particular site were painted black. So therefore, at night, there was no way that a pilot would have seen them, let alone being chased or chasing after one. So, you know, a lot of the time, the explanations, whilst they might make sense to a desk officer or the press might have thought, yeah, okay, well, that makes sense as well. We'll just, you know, we'll not bother investigating or not bother reporting it too much. As far as the crews and the witnesses were concerned, then, you know, it didn't seem to match what they were seeing. But there was no kind of right reply, if you like. You know, the military personnel couldn't come back and counter it, because that was it. As far as the investigators were concerned, it was like an open and shut case. And as far as airline pilots were concerned, well, there was nothing to be gained by rocking the boat. And the people who did, you know, they didn't get very far by doing it.
There's something you mention about, you know, if Roswell really was a crashed craft that was retrieved, then there's no sign that the people at Sign and Grudge and Blue Book would ever knew about that. It's almost like you get that compartmentalization, don't you?
Yeah. No, sorry. I've always had a hard job trying to reconcile Roswell with everything else going on back then. That's not to say I'm saying that Roswell didn't exist, and far from it. There's something happened then, but as to what it was and what the scale of it was and how it impacted on everything else, I simply have no idea. Now, when I first heard about Roswell back in the early 1980s, it was this amazing story about the possibility of crash retrievals and even possibly beings on board and all the rest of it. But as time's gone on, the stories became sort of a bit more murky and a bit muddled, because people who have said they were part of it, of this, whatever happened, turned out they're not part of it and they've made things up, or they've exaggerated their role in it, or sometimes just flat out lied about it. So that kind of, you know, sort of muddies the waters in terms of what really happened. And unfortunately, now we're so far forward in history that from the actual event itself, that all the people who were involved with it have died. So we're already going on effectively testimony at the time, some of it reliable possibly, others unreliable, and we have to weave our way between all of it. And the few documents that exist don't really tell us that much. We've got obviously the photographs from the time, which try to portray the fact that it was a weather balloon or a radar reflector or a kite of some description. And, you know, we're just no further forward, I'm afraid, with the story. Everybody seems to have a pet theory as to what happened, whether it's, you know, whether it were aliens or whether it was some secret technology from another country or whether it was, you know, or whether it was some kind of elaborate hoax. Or whether it was some secret American project regarding dummies or all the rest of it, you name it. You've probably heard all the stories yourself. You know, as to which one of those it is, then who knows? It's just so confusing now, this story. And then when you add everything else that's going on at the time, so these official UFO investigation projects, were they just shams? You know, did they know what was going on? This is where you fall down the kind of conspiracy rabbit hole. You know, was there something going on in the background? But if so, why don't, you know, why isn't there any information that anybody's been able to find out about it? It's not as if you can look through the, you know, the archives and find out this kind of smoking gun in terms of documentation from the time. And people have tried, and yet there seems to be nothing available. So they've either done a very, very good job in hiding not just the craft and the people who were in, you know, involved in the project to retrieve it and to work on it and to examine it, but even to this day it's all very, very tightly wrapped up. Now, you know, I guess, yes, okay, if you have your conspiracy hat on, you can think, yeah, that, you know, people are very good at keeping secrets, but actually governments and intelligence agencies on the whole aren't that good at things like that, and that information usually comes out somewhere. So whoever, if there is something like this, that these people are breaking the mold and they're very good at their job. And I just somehow don't think that's the case.
Yeah, because I wonder about this compartmentalization. It's that thing of, I could imagine that there'd be a group in the army who were studying UFOs, a group in the Navy, a group in the Air Force, and they're so tight about it and so secure, these different groups wouldn't know about each other.
It's possible, yeah. I guess if I have a pet theory about it, if I am to buy into the fact that something was discovered, then that's fair enough. And my only suggestion is that it's possible that if there is something buried away somewhere, like some project that's buried away in a secret facility, then what they must be doing, because obviously there's no evidence of anything coming to light from it, that they must not know what they're looking at. And they may have thrown scientists at it at the time and said, look, you know, try and work out what this thing is. And they can't fathom it out. And every so often when they have developments in technology and understanding of physics and all the rest of it, they then go back to it and say, okay, can we try and explain or try and fly it now? And they still can't. And it's just so, this just keeps happening every few years, or every time there's some kind of breakthrough in technology or understanding, they will then go back to it at this secret facility and think, okay, can we understand it now? Can we get it to work now? And maybe they're still not there yet. And that's the only thing that I think might be stopping them coming forward with whatever it is and saying, this is what it is, this is what it does, and this is how, you know, this is how it operates, is because they simply still don't know what they're looking at. But if that's the case, then it's really, really secretive, and they've done a very, very good job in 75 years since it happened. And you see other projects and you see other things and you see leaks from projects, even very, very secret ones. And you see the likes of the stealth fighter and the stealth bomber. And okay, yes, at the time they were, you know, ultra secret, but that information still came out. People still saw them, still, you know, had pretty good handles on what these things were. And then they were unveiled to the public, you know, 12, 15, 20 years later sort of thing. But nothing of this, you know, there's not a peep in terms of what these things are and who's working on them and where they're kept. You know, are they Russian? Well, if they are, then the Russians have never come forward about this super secret technology. And if the Russians had things that could do this kind of, you know, these kind of maneuvers and these kind of speeds and outfly American interceptors and all the rest of it, then they'd be winning the war in Ukraine hands down, and they're not. So it's clearly not Russian. China wasn't even a thing back then in terms of a military and technological, you know, kind of infrastructure. They're not like they are now in terms of being able to develop, you know, sort of much more modern technology in terms of warfare and weapons and all the rest of it. Whereas back then, they had nothing like that, really. They were still relying on cast-offs and hand-me-downs from Russia. So it's unlikely that in 1947 it was Chinese. The only other option would be Russian, but for the reasons I've said, you know, I just don't think it's theirs either. So yeah, we'll come back to America. And is it some buried project? And if it is, it's really well hidden.
And as far as the technology goes, if it was recovered interplanetary craft, it's like you say, if we got hold of it, it might be like Isaac Newton with a battery-dead iPhone.
Yeah, well, that's the example, the kind of, you know, the parallel I give in the book. You know, you hand Isaac Newton an iPhone. Now, even if it's got battery, he'll, you know, push it, and it is just like a bit of glass and metal with some fancy kind of little writing and pictures on it. But then when the battery goes, he's got no method of actually charging it up. If he even knew what it was, he has no concept of what a mobile phone is. He doesn't understand the technology involved. He doesn't understand the purpose of one. You can't make a call with it because there's no cell towers or anything like that. There's no infrastructure set up around the world to use it. And it won't exist for another 300 or 400 years anyway. So what do you do with a hunk of metal and glass, which is effectively dead? It doesn't do anything. You know, how do you understand it? How do you interpret it? How do you, if you take it apart, you're not going to be any further forward because you don't know how the bits work. And here's another one. Let's say, let's not like look at an iPhone for an example. Let's look at an atom bomb. So you give, I don't know, a Victorian scientist an atom bomb. Now, if they look at an atom bomb, then they don't know what it is. They might think it's some kind of weapon because it's something bomb-shaped. I guess you might be able to translate that as being something offensive and something dangerous. But your natural kind of instinct will be to take it apart and see what it is. Now, if you take an atom bomb apart, you're going to kill yourself because of the radiation. Therefore, or it's going to explode, or at least the uranium or the plutonium or whatever is in the bomb is going to kill you because of the exposure to radiation. But you're not going to know that because you don't understand the physics behind it. And anybody who comes to your rescue is probably going to die as well. So, you know, where are you going to get in terms of trying to understand and interpret an atom bomb if you have no knowledge of what one is, because it's like 100 years in the future or something like that? So you can see the kind of difficulties that are involved in trying to, you know, sort of examine and understand something that might be hundreds, if not thousands of years in terms of your technology in the future.
Can we talk about another one of the cases in the book? The one that stood out was the Australian Sea Fury case.
Oh, yeah. So this is from, I think it's August 1954. And I class this as, the episode title is called The Wingtip Wingman. So, yeah, there's a Royal Australian Navy Sea Fury pilot. And the pilot's called Seamus O'Farrell. And he has this mysterious light that's flying off his wingtip on a nighttime training flight. And this is the 31st of August, 1954. So yeah, it's a weird story. And he sees this thing and he's contacting like the local airbase to see whether there's another aircraft in the vicinity. And they say there's nothing. They don't have it on radar. They had echoes on radar, but they didn't know what they were. And it was actually two bright lights that he was seeing. So of course, naturally the explanation was, well, it's another aircraft. But there was nothing, you know, nothing chalked up to that at all. And actually, at the time when he landed, there was he was given a thorough medical examination, and also, you know, the doctor wanted to know whether he'd been drinking through the day. So there was a kind of like suggestion that he might have been, you know, sort of under the influence when he was flying. And again, here's your stigma again. You know, they're trying to like sort of suggest that he wasn't in control of his faculties.
But there was something there, wasn't it? It was on radar.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. It was picked up on radar and he saw something as well. But as to what that was, then, you know, who knows? It was almost like a Foo Fighter report, that, you know, from the war, where lights had been seen, which were quite close to an aeroplane and following an aeroplane. But in this case, it was actually picked up by radar as well.
Yeah, and I was going to mention the Foo Fighters because, as far as I know, they were only ever balls of light that were actually quite small.
Well, they were certainly balls of light, yeah. But in terms of the size, then nobody knows really what size they were, because it's difficult if you don't know the size of an object to work out the distance and vice versa. So if you're looking at a ball of light, you don't know whether it's going to be 5 foot or 10 foot or 100 foot wide and how far away it is. But yeah, there were certainly balls of light.
And by 1953, 54, they had been replaced by craft. It seems like the Foo Fighters were disappearing into the past and the craft were becoming more and more what people saw.
I think so, yeah. There was certainly more kind of structured craft, if you like, being seen. But also there were still lights being seen in the sky, Simon. So people were still seeing, you know, pilots were still seeing strange, effectively balls of light or lights that were following their airplanes or being seen in the distance, etc. So these kind of things were still being seen. And some things were being seen during the Korean War as well. So, you know, if you call them Foo Fighters or you want to call them something else, whatever these things were, they were still around, just not necessarily the numbers that were being seen during World War II and in such concentrated areas.
This has been a great conversation. The book is called Intercept and Identify Aerial UFO Encounters, 1953 to 1954. That's on Amazon and other places, is it?
It's just on Amazon. Yeah, that's exclusively to Amazon.
And do you have a website?
If you look at my Twitter profile, so that's at Border750, there's a link there to my website, which is rivercountrybooks.com.
Great. And thanks again for coming back to the podcast. And you'll have to let me know when the new book's out and you can come back again.
I will do, Simon. Thanks very much.
And that was an interview with Graham Rendell about his book, Intercept and Identify, Aerial UFO Encounters, 1953 to 1954. And if you want to hear the rest of this fantastic interview, you'll need to sign up to Patreon for the extended episode. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. If you join the $4.50 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $7.50 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. And when you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and released 2 days before the free versions. Please check out my other podcast. It's called Past Lives Podcast, and there are over 260 episodes. On the Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of the afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. I also release an extra episode of the Past Lives Podcast every Thursday, and that's called Paranormal Stories. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regression. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me, and you've signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. My Instagram is pastlivespodcast with an underscore between each word. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review. And be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. It seems like these sightings were going on all the time, all around the world. And then the response from the people in authority, their response just seems to be so small, like they just weren't interested.
Yeah, you have to wonder about the motivation. Is it simply because they knew something was happening, so they were part of a big cover-up, and it was a way just to kind of dampen down, you know, sort of the public's interest?